In 2002, Republicans were ascendant. George W. Bush had been elected by an almost non-existent margin in 2000, when 9 months later he became a wartime president. Al-Qaeda had attacked the United States on September the 11th, 2001. 1 year later, in 2002, Bush's popularity hit 84%. He had a popular war and a strong economy going for him. Democrats were in utter despair. Then in late 2002, a book was published. It was an unlikely popular book, full of charts and graphs and dense arguments about demographic change. Before the emerging Democratic majority was published, I don't think more than a handful of Democratic activists knew even what demographic change meant. But it rallied Democrats. It was a roadmap for a restored Democratic Party success built on an analysis that ignored the wars and the economy. Demographics were the facts that dominated, not just in the next big election, but a permanent majority. And the authors, Rui Teixeira and John Judas, were seen by Democrats as a kind of biblical Moses leading us out of bondage and pointing the way to a bright new world that was within our grasp. Today, 20 tumultuous years later, Rui Teixeira plays a far different role. Rather than a Moses leading his followers to the promised land, he's become more of a biblical Jeremiah, denouncing the failures of the wayward Democratic Party. He writes and speaks with a frankness that always astonishes and often outrages. One biographical note, Teixeira is neither a sheltered academic, despite the fact that he has a PhD in sociology, or a hardened campaign operative. He has spent his life immersed in the study of our politics in one or another think tank. I describe him as an American public intellectual who's observed and debated our political lives for half a century. I should offer a trigger warning before you listen to this interview. If you are at all a Democrat who thinks of yourself as a progressive, you're going to hear some of your cherished assumptions forcefully challenged. Let's hear what Rui Teixeira has to say. This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation. So good to see you.
Good to see you.
So let me take you back to 2002, the publication of the Emerging Democratic Majority. How would you describe the existing climate of opinion within the Democratic Party at that point?
Well, I mean, I would say people were pretty discouraged. I mean, they thought that, Gore would win in 2000. They didn't get how Bush could possibly have been elected. A lot of people were sort of turning against the Clintonism of the 90s and thinking maybe everything was a big mistake. Maybe the Republicans seemed to have the wind at their back. How on earth did this happen? What can we do? And our take was to look at the political trends of the 80s and 90s going into this period and take a careful look at what those underlying trends might be geographically, ideologically, public opinion, and just see what it all has to tell us about where the country is going. And our view is that notwithstanding the results of the 2000 election, you could sort of detect in the voting patterns and demographic changes and economic changes of the previous 20 years, a tilting of the political terrain in a way that really favored the Democrats in terms of the rise of professionals, the changing race, ethnic, demographic mix of the country, the changing role and tendencies of women voters, the changing political behavior of some of the most dynamic metropolitan areas in the country, which we've called ideopolises. We just thought all of that added up to a political climate potentially that would be beneficial to the Democrats if they played their cards right. And it certainly wasn't right to be as discouraged as people were. In fact, there were great opportunities potentially to be seized by the Democrats, emphasize the word potentially. And, 2002 happened, 2004 happened, people were increasingly skeptical, but then the worm turned. And then you really, with the Obama election of 2008 and the coalition he put together, it really looked a lot like what we were talking about in the emerging Democratic majority. And I think people then became not only more receptive to our analysis, but probably overly receptive. They spiked the football and said, hey, you know, this is like, we can just put it on autopilot here. What those guys are saying is true. The country's changing so much, and we're on the right side of history.
I remember Democrats trying to summarize your book, and the words that would come out were, we just have a demographic tidal wave in our favor. We just ride the wave, and we'll have victory after victory. It was a very passive kind of explanation. But so was that a correct reading of your book?
our analysis was much more complex than that and had a lot to do with how the country was changing in terms of its economics, in terms of its geography. A lot of things that couldn't be reduced to just, I think, what people really meant when they said, talked about demographics, which is basically race, that there are going to be fewer white voters, especially white working class voters, and more, you know, what we now call voters of color and non-whites or whatever. And that would be, you know, sort of this automatic dividend that would push a lot of these places in America and toward the Democrats. And they completely ignored, A, the complexity of our analysis, the contingent nature of it. It depended a lot on how Democrats played things. And critically, and this turned out to be hugely important, we pointed out, made pains to point out in the book, that if you're talking about white working class voters, it's absolutely true they're declining as a share of voters. But it's also absolutely true there's still a huge share of voters, especially in a lot of states that really count. And Democrats can't make this emerging political arithmetic work unless they managed to hold on to a core, a very significant core of white working class voters. Again, particularly in certain states. And if that started slipping, it would negate the ability of Democrats to put together the coalition that seemed possible. So I thought that was widely ignored. I mean, it was widely ignored really when Obama won in 2008. People didn't really factor in, well, you know, he actually did relatively well among white working class voters, particularly in the upper Midwest. And that was good, and it was also a key to him coming back and winning the 2012 election. Real key to that election wasn't the rising American electorate. It was that Obama did much better than expected in the upper Midwest coming after the 2010 shellacking.
Can we just sort of stop? You know, the rising American electorate is what? What was that the title for?
Well, rising American electorate was connected in people's minds, I guess, to our book, but it was a sort of stock phrase. It was promulgated by basically Democratic-leaning operatives and pollsters and so on, and advocacy groups. And it was believed to consist of, obviously, non-whites, Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, more college-educated and progressive whites, single women, and the younger generations who appeared to be leaning toward the Democrats. So depending on how they wanted to count all these groups without double counting them, it wound up sounding like a lot of people. That became quite a catchphrase for people. And that led into exactly what you're saying. It's kind of passive. It's, well, this rising American electorate is so big and impressive that all we have to do is, you know, sort of make sure we talk to these people and get them out to vote. And there's really no need to worry about persuasion with the rest of the electorate, or in a sense, even persuasion with these voters, because they were sort of viewed as, in a sense, being automatically on the Democrat side. So we never thought very much of that analysis. And I think that has proven to be a correct judgment.
And there was a very large group left out of that American electorate, that is the white working class.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's huge. And not only that, the embedded assumption that the Democrats are always going to have the votes of non-whites, particularly non-white working class voters, and there couldn't possibly be any attrition on that score, has also turned out to be wrong. Democrats, and this is something we didn't anticipate in our book, they would move so far to the left on cultural issues, right? I mean, we talked about a progressive centrism in our book that would sort of accord with the general changes that were taking place in American culture, which were definitely liberalizing, but they weren't radical. They were tolerant. They were, you know, sort of an America where people could be the kind of person they are and nobody would discriminate against them, but also nobody gets handed out special favors just because of their descriptive characteristics. And no, you know, certainly we didn't think that it would be a great idea for Democrats to start running around talking about how America's a white supremacist society and policing people's language and you know, sort of being implicitly for open borders and a variety of other things, which became, you know, unaccountably popular in Democratic circles in the late teens and early 20s, which is definitely hurting them with a lot of these voters. We didn't anticipate that, and I think we didn't anticipate that because we didn't realize the extent to which the liberal college-educated sector of the Democratic Party would really start to dominate the party, really, really start to set the tone. We didn't anticipate that, particularly, you know, how the younger cohorts of the liberal intelligentsia, including, oddly enough, white, you know, it's really white college grad, liberal white college graduates, the most important group here. I mean, they purport to be supporting Blacks and Hispanics, but in reality, they have their own worldview and they push it forward very vigorously, whether or not this is in fact in the interests of sort of your median Black or Hispanic working class voter. So all of those things, I think, kind of went wrong and were based on either a misinterpretation of what we said in the book or basically reflect things, to be honest, we just didn't anticipate. I mean, this turn toward cultural radicalism was a bit of a surprise to us and I'm sure many other people.
So now we seem to be in an era in which the two political parties are, I mean, this is kind of an odd thing to say, the two political parties are really good at losing elections by very close margins. And it seems to me one of the reasons they're good at losing elections is the only way they can figure out to win elections is to win on very, very slim margins as well. Joe Biden's victory was razor thin. Donald Trump's victory was razor thin. And we seem to be whipsawing between the two. That is not at all a vision of an electoral situation in which there is a demographically solid community behind either party at this point.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's our view, myself and John Judas. We are actually publishing a book this year in November called Where Have All the Democrats Gone, which basically tries to analyze what's happened in the 20 years since we published The Emerging Democratic Majority and look at the ways in which the American political system has evolved to this weird stasis between the parties, where neither party is capable of pushing forward a really dominant coalition, you know, razor sharp victories and alternation of power is kind of the norm. Both parties, I think, rely to some extent on demonizing the other side, trying to make the extreme parts of the other party salient to voters. So the idea is to discredit your opponent and make them into extremists rather than to make them love you. And I think that's where we are now. I mean, it's sort of how elections turn out is in large part determined by which craziness and which party is the most salient in any given time.
You've come forward, though, with three pretty darn substantive proposals to the Democratic Party and stirred quite a bit of controversy. I'd like to turn now into that. So you want to lay out your three ideas?
Well, my three ideas, my three-point plan to fix the Democrats and their coalition is actually quite simple. The three components are Democrats must move to the center on cultural issues, Democrats must promote an abundance agenda, and Democrats should embrace patriotism and liberal nationalism. So I've written quite a lot about all three of those parts. And I do think these are all things that Democrats could do and should do, and wouldn't at all, in many ways, compromise the core of their progressive program, but is going to be difficult for them to do because of basically the left or progressive wing of the party is a very different idea about all this stuff and will fight tooth and nail, for example, against attempts to move to the center on cultural issues, to emphasize law and order, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, to emphasize border security, to turn down the volume on all this, you know, sort of outre, you know, America's a racist society, where all white people are racist by virtue of their privilege and the history of the country, and really try to get back to a tolerant, you know, open-minded, anti-discrimination. We're all equal here, and everybody should have an equal opportunity to get ahead, but we're not going to equalize outcomes. you know, because merit and achievement and all this stuff still counts. All of this stuff should not be, is hardly foreign to the Democratic Party. It was what people were saying like 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Obama had mostly the right perspective, I think, on a lot of this stuff. But he's now in, you know, sort of more ignored than paid attention to. And the rising left of the party has really defined the terms of the cultural debate and the cultural outlook of the party. And as I've argued many times, and you know, I'm hardly the only person to point this out, there's sort of this big amen corner in, you know, in the media, in academia, in nonprofits and advocacy groups, foundations. There's this whole, the arts, there's this whole swath of, you know, very influential institutional actors who have now been hegemonized by, you know, sort of the liberal white college graduates and, you know, obviously a fair amount of non-whites as well, who just have this kind of, for want of a better word, this woke point of view and insist that it's kind of a precondition for being progressive and try to police others into embracing their views on things. So that, you know, that is now kind of where we are, and it creates huge problems for the Democrats in terms of making what should be obvious and simple moves toward the center. Same thing is true on embracing patriotism and liberal nationalism. A lot of, I just wrote about this yesterday or today. You know, for a lot of these activists and elites, you know, patriotism is kind of uncool. It's kind of like a borderline reactionary, right? I mean, why should we hold our country above others? Why should we be patriotic? Why should we believe in the flag? Why should we celebrate July 4th? Why should we, you know, wasn't Lincoln like, didn't he just free the slaves because he kind of had to and he didn't really want to? And, you know, wasn't Jefferson a slave owner? I mean, you know, the litany goes on and on and on. There is no historical figure that you can't find something wrong with and reflected in the tenor of the times and the political conflicts of the time. But the idea somehow we should like cashier all these people out of, you know, the Democratic Party and its history or denounce them or separate ourselves from them is just ridiculous. And I think for most normie voters, they feel the same way. But again, that's something that the Democratic Party, elements of the Democratic Party, not happy with. In terms of the abundance agenda, as I pointed out, you know, it's great the Democrats managed to get some bills passed. It's good to legislate. One can, you know, there have been some problems with inflation for sure, and Democrats, I think, have been a little bit asleep at the switch on that. But, you know, we did need to fund some of these moves forward in terms of the country's infrastructure and investments. That's a good thing. But on the other hand, there's so many things that are preventing us from actually doing good things with the money. The whole regulatory and permitting structure of the country tends to militate against all the things that people want to build and strengthen about America's infrastructure. And, you know, so of course, everybody's really into this clean energy transition, which, you know, is another, you know, sort of difficult area where I think Democrats have a little bit gone off the rails in terms of their commitment to a very rapid transition toward use of renewables in place of fossil fuels, which is, as that good old Vaclav Smil observed, some people call this aspirational, I call it delusional, because I think, you know, any fair-minded attention to the data about industrial society in general and our society in particular suggests this is just, you know, this is just a fantasy.
Could we just pause? Let's just pause and make that clear to folks. Vaclav Smil is whom?
Vaclav Smil is this polymathic professor from Canada who writes a lot about energy and growth.
His big book is?
Yeah, How the World Really Works. That's the best one to read. Everything he writes is very interesting, but How the World Really Works is becoming a seminal volume because he basically breaks down the energy use in the world into, you know, various components and shows how integral they are to industrial civilization, food, cement, plastics, and so on. I mean, all these things are, they take fossil fuels and you can't replace them very fast. People tend to look at it mistakenly just in terms of the electricity grid, which is hard enough to start connecting massive numbers of renewables to the electricity grid. So looked at globally and breaking it down by sector, you know, you start understanding why, you know, over 80% of the world's energy still comes from fossil fuels. And that percentage will only go down slowly. It should go down. It can go down, but you can't wave a magic wand and do it. And you can't just like rely completely on wind and solar. This is a complete, as I say, fantasy. Yeah, for your listeners, everybody should check out Vaclav Smil, How the World Really Works. It'll blow your mind.
I want to go back, if we can, just we've talked about the cultural issues quite a bit. So I think there's I think you've given folks a sense of where you are on that. And the patriotism and liberal nationalism is pretty straightforwardly, it's to be simple, it's obvious kind of argument to make. The abundance agenda, I don't think we've spent enough time just explaining to folks what your very straight ahead thought is on that. I'd like folks to come out of this interview having a real sense of what the key points are. Abundance agenda to you means what?
The abundance agenda to me means, I mean, in the simplest possible form, I suppose you could say that Democrats, people on the left, should stand literally for abundance, for more things, more stuff, more comfortable lives for people, you know, rapidly rising living standards. You know, you need to get out of this degrowth or low growth mindset and realize that everything good about American society today that people really enjoy, I mean, leaving aside a democratic institution, but their actual material life comes from technological advance and economic growth. And that needs to be unleashed, right? I mean, if we want people to have better lives, you need to have a wealthier society, of course, with the wealth, you know, better distributed for sure. But it is a necessary condition that growth be robust, fast, and dynamic. And the way to do that is you can't just redistribute money. You can't just spend money, really. You have to make sure that the way the productive forces develop in the society really takes, you know, is able to happen to its fullest extent. So, for example, if you're going to spend a lot of money on renewables and electric cars, and let's leave aside whether that's the best use of the money, I mean, you have to realize that this stuff isn't going to work unless, you know, there's a massive build out of high voltage, long distance transmission lines. And the reason why that's not happening, and it will not happen, is because of how difficult it is to get this stuff done, given political, legal, and regulatory obstacles. So in a way, these people are shooting themselves in the foot. The Princeton Consortium on the clean energy transition put out a paper showing that 80% of this carbon reduction that's alleged to follow from the Inflation Reduction Act would not happen unless, you know, there was a radically increased rate of building of this infrastructure. You could say the same thing about the infrastructure bill itself. A lot of the stuff is happening extremely slowly. The money's there, but it's very hard to get this stuff done fast. And it costs way too much, right? I mean, the cost in America for building transportation infrastructure is almost an order of magnitude more, or at least 5 or 6 times more than it is in other societies. None of this makes any sense. And the ability of NEPA regulations, right? This sort of the thing that came out of the environmental movement of the 60s and 70s, which had a lot of good aspects to begin with, is now turned into sort of this Frankenstein monster that's being used to thwart development of needed infrastructure and just building stuff because it can be frivolously used to delay the implementation of various plans because you have there's a million different ways you can slow things down with NEPA. So all of this stuff is not congenial to the abundant society, right? If we want abundance, it's not going to be enough just to redistribute what money we have or what growth we have. I mean, I think that is what some Democrats would prefer. They really don't even like the idea of growth very much. I think it's growth is associated with consumerism and ruining the environment. And I think there's some truth to that, but you know, growth is also what makes life worth living and what's made the living standard that people enjoy in the United States possible. And I think what people want is higher living standards, not lower living standards.
Good point. Let's put our arms around it then. So you've urged a return to the center on cultural issues, which will be a very electrifying issue to progressives. An abundance agenda, which means a very different mindset from a quote-unquote sort of environmental orientation with the environment taking priority. And a return to patriotism in America, which, I mean, my conversations with lots of folks these days on that topic turn into them explaining to me that there really is no such thing as a country. Countries are imaginary communities, and patriotism is a figment of imagination. So it almost goes beyond the old objections to patriotism, which were the country is not worthy of patriotism, to the new intellectual approaches to say it doesn't even exist. So you made this point early in this conversation, but I'm bringing us back to it now. This is going to be a very difficult thing for progressives within the Democratic Party to swallow. What is your sense of what will happen along those lines? Look, if a presidential candidate was nominated by the party and embraced your views somewhat, would Bernie Sanders vote for that candidate?
I think Bernie Sanders would, for sure. Some of his younger followers, I guess we'd have the wonder about that. But if we hypothesize that this reformed Democratic candidate, who in some way, manner, shape, or form was embracing my three-point plan and definitely represented a break from current Democratic Party orthodoxy, how much, the really question you're asking is, how much would that candidate suffer from defections among progressive Democrats?
Sure,
who
that's what I'm asking.
To vote
right.
for such a candidate. And my view is, given that they will be running against the Republican candidate, I don't think that's such a big deal. I think most people will maybe not be happy, some of these people, but they'll nevertheless vote for our renewal candidate over the Republican Party. And I think I've always thought it's overblown when progressives claim that only their progressive agenda in its most full-throated form can motivate the turnout Democrats need. There's a lot of political science and other evidence suggesting that's just not true. In fact, more extreme candidates tend to do worse than moderate candidates. In fact, you don't benefit that much in turnout. You actually gin up the turnout on the other side. So it's not clear to me at all that a normie Democratic candidate would suffer from like unsustainable levels of sort of turnout decline.
Yeah, I kind of like to go back and dwell for a moment on one of the points you just made there, and that is that it is a trope in the progressive community that a strong campaign for very strident issues will create turnout on the Democratic side. And the response to that in the academic community and the political community has been, just as you said, to point out that in the era of television, you can't communicate to just one side, and the other side hears your message as well. Walk us through what your thought is on what happens in that case then.
Well, what happens in that case is that if, in fact, the strong progressive views that you're advocating the Democrats embrace and run on are heard by the other side, you're actually like giving away your opportunity to persuade people who are more in the middle, who in fact are more salient for deciding elections than the others, than these strong progressives whose turnout might fluctuate a little bit. And in fact, we generally find, the studies that have looked at this seem to find that in fact, if you run in a fairly strenuously progressive or extreme platform, you may increase turnout a little bit from your party, or at least segments of your party, but actually you tend to gin up turnout more on the other side. So it's not even a net positive in terms of turnout, and it's definitely a net negative in terms of persuasion. So, there are always a lot of moving parts in elections, but I think the idea that the key to Democratic strength, victories in the future is to gin up turnout of progressive constituencies by taking super progressive positions is just incorrect. I think it's borne out by the empirical record. I don't think it makes sense theoretically. And one thing that's, I think, important to emphasize here, Wally, is I think a lot of these people who advocate for this strenuously progressive approach are assuming that progressive approach is going to really mobilize, like, for example, Black and Hispanic voters. which I think is viewed as the core progressive constituency. But the fact of the matter is most Black and Hispanic voters are kind of moderate. You know, they're not necessarily going to respond to this strenuously progressive approach. They might be quite happy with a moderate normie Democratic candidate who presents a contrast to the other side, but who seems safe and you know, sort of sounds like they know what they're talking about and they're not off in cloud cuckoo land somewhere. So in other words, progressive candidates may make your average liberal to radical white college graduate very happy, but the core of the progressive constituencies in the Democratic Party that the Democratic Party relies upon so much may in fact not be motivated by this stuff. They may in fact be quite happy with a more moderate candidate. And I think, again, the record bears this out. I mean, as the Democratic Party has moved to the left on cultural and racial issues, we have not seen a tsunami of Hispanic and Black turnout relative to other constituencies. And we've actually seen attrition in the levels of support among Black and Hispanic, especially Hispanic working class people for the Democrats. So I think none of this really computes, but I think it's just almost like a matter of almost a religious view of the nature of politics, which I think connects to the almost quasi-religious nature of the way a lot of people on the progressive left look at politics and their view of the world and the view of American society. And it connects too to the thing we were talking about earlier about the rising American electorate. They've got this thing in their brain, rising American electorate. You know, we have the advantage. Demographics is destiny. The only problem we have is getting these people to vote. If we get them to vote, we win. And it's like persuasion just goes out the window, which I think is a huge mistake.
I have a little different thought to contribute to that. And bluntly, there's an awful lot in what you say that aligns with my own personal views. So I have a hard time disagreeing, but it could be productive. When I discuss these issues with young progressives, a reaction I get is, you're just an old guy who's simply not facing the new world that the young people face. Bluntly, the young generation is one of the most pessimistic group of people I've met in my life. And you and I lived through the Vietnam era when there was a lot to be pessimistic about when our country was seemingly coming apart at the seams. But the young folks today are saying, talk to me about an abundance agenda. How is that going to happen? Everything I've seen in my entire adult life has been recession or inflation, followed by a little bit of good times, followed by recession and inflation. I'm a renter. I'll always be a renter. There's no hope that I'll have a home. There is a profound discontent and sense of hopelessness among a lot of young people. And so I think I'm concerned that your optimism that a person could adopt the agenda you've sketched and not suffer a significant loss at the polls might be wrong. What's your thought on that?
Well, again, if we're looking at, I mean, I think the embedded assumption here about these pessimistic young people who sound like they're pretty, you know, not exactly conservative, committed conservatives, the kind of people you're talking about are more people who, you know, are probably pretty liberal, pretty educated, you know, they think everything's screwed up. I mean, there's whole doomer subcultures people have been writing about lately. Who think the United States is just, you know, it's like a hellhole. I mean, no wonder people are pessimistic. Everything sucks.
I may very well be. Look, I live in Los Angeles, and I live in Los Angeles. And on top of that, Rui, I live in a city council district that was represented by a very liberal member of city council who lost it just recently to a leader of the Democratic Socialists of America, Hugo Soto Martinez, who ran openly on a defund the police platform. So you're quite right. I live in a rather particular community. But I'm serious about it. I'm serious about it because I am concerned. How do we maintain unity in the Democratic Party in order to win? And how assured can we be that people like you, people like me, can voice these views and still keep the party's turnout strong enough for victory?
Well, I think this is really just a reformulation of the previous problem, which is people believe that only the strenuously progressive approach can generate adequate turnout among core progressive constituents to win. And I just reject that proposition. I find it not particularly credible that Democrats, by being more moderate in some respects and embracing some of the things we talked about, will so turn off young, left-leaning voters that they just won't show up. I mean, they're not going to vote for the Republicans, okay? That doesn't seem likely to happen, but they just won't show up. I think that's the fear. I just don't buy it. I mean, again, I think the empirical historical record is that this is not how elections are decided. They're not decided by not being progressive enough, and the super progressive people don't show up, or the young people you're talking about don't show up. I think enough of them will show up anyway, and who knows, they might surprise us. We might get more turnout, because one reason why youth turnout is so low, younger generation turnout is so low, is because they're so friggin' cynical about politics, right? I mean, they just, what's the difference? We live in a hellhole. Well, maybe we shouldn't put up with that. Maybe we should sort of point out things are not that bad and things can get better, you know? And in fact, we can have better lives than we do and quit whining and saying about how terrible everything is because in fact, it's not that bad. And in fact, America is capable of providing better lives for people. But, you know, I don't see what the point is of sort of accepting or underscoring or uniting with them on the idea this is, you know, we live in an absolute hellhole and you're right about that. And only like super radical change can change things. Because I suspect even those young voters in their hearts know you're not going to like radically transform the country tomorrow by voting for some radical candidates. I mean, it's silly. It's a fantasy. And why not urge them to be more realistic about politics and, you know, push the ball forward? I mean, I can't really think of anything else to do. I just don't think it's useful politically and substantively incorrect to agree with those kind of super pessimistic doomer type sentiments.
We were talking about how the two political parties have been unable to mobilize a strong enough constituency so that they can not only win an election, but win it in terms so that you can govern. You come into the presidency with a 5-vote margin in the House of Representatives. Good luck. You come into the presidency where your narrow control of the Senate is that your vice president can cast the deciding vote. Good luck. So do you think your agenda has the potential to turn victory for the Democratic Party from a 51% victory, which is the kind of stuff we've been dealing with for years now, into something more substantial?
Yes, that's precisely my point, really, is that it's not the case that if Democrats don't adopt a different approach, they will never win any elections. Clearly, they do win elections, so they alternate with the other side, but typically they win them rather narrowly, and it's not a stable governing majority that stick around long enough to really do big stuff. And that's why they try to shoehorn so many things into whenever they do have control of government, probably more than it can really fit. But yes, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, you want to get to the point where we're not, you know, a 50-50 or 51-49 nation perpetually. You want to, if you think you're the, you know, this is the party that can put America on the right course, right its wrongs, make it a dynamic, fast-growing society that delivers benefits, you know, across a wide range of social strata, then by God, you need 53-47 or 54-46. And to do that, you have to get the voters in the middle. It is wrong that you can get to that point simply by mobilizing your most loyal constituencies even more than you already have. That's why, you know, a different approach needs to be adopted that will strike these voters in the middle as being more where their heads are at. You know, we need more normie voters. We don't need more super progressive voters. And so that's really what my whole program and approach is all about, turning the Democrats into a normie voter party.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of thought that's where you were headed. So your thought is, this is not a campaign consultant saying to the candidate, we're faced with an election 24 months from now. We've got to whip together a program that'll give us 50.1% of the vote so that you can get elected and I can get paid. This is a very different vision. You're foreseeing how long do you think it will take to move in that direction? I mean, just you've pointed out the difficulty of implementing the programs Joe Biden got passed. With all respect to those programs, which are large and very important, they're just a beginning to move in that. The direction, yeah, the direction was excellent, but we have a long way to go on that. And if the party does not succeed in 2024, it's just another interrupted attempt that looked promising at the beginning and then went wither. So how long do you think that will take to move the party in that direction, any party in that direction, and amass that kind of central support?
Yeah, I mean, first I want to underscore what you said about, I'm not handing out advice, and I don't have a license to do so, about how to win the very next election. That's a fool's errand, or that's a consultant's errand. And I'm urging people to think much bigger. Think about how you can actually have a dominant coalition and get big things done. And, you know, transforming America is not a 1 year or 2 year job. It takes quite a while. So you should be aiming for that. And if you're aiming for that, you know, I mean, I would make the same argument to the other side. I think the Republicans, I would not rule out them being able to reform themselves and present a different face to the public and potentially do some of the things that need to be done to form their majority coalition. Right now, they aren't doing it. So in a sense, that's why it's a great opportunity for the Democrats to sort of sand off the rough edges, stop saying dumb things, have a much more attractive program to moderate, persuadable voters, and actually form that coalition. I mean, Democrats should be asking themselves every day, with as crazy as much of the Republican Party is and as Trumpified as it is, you know, why can't you beat them and beat them good, you know, as opposed to just squeaking through? So that's what they should do. That's really my, you know, what I'm recommending. As for how long it'll take, well, that's always difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. And, I would not rule out them getting their act together before 2024. On the other hand, I'm not particularly optimistic either. It looks like, you know, it's going to be Biden will be the nominee. I don't think he'll run on anything particularly different than what they're already running on. Look at our great accomplishments. Republicans are crazy, you know, et cetera. And he's not going to move to the center on practically anything. So I don't think his party will let him. And he's certainly not the kind of guy who's going to stand up to them. So in fact, we may be looking a cycle or two down the line, realistically. But, you know, I'd love to be proven wrong.
So we're looking for a presidential candidate currently in their late 30s, maybe early 40s. She's a young comer. She has a bright future ahead of herself and begins talking about the direction America could move in, and 10 years from now has a real run.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, we don't know who that person is, person or persons, but I think that's probably what we're looking for down the road, and it will take some time. Hopefully it'll happen in this decade. but I'm thinking the currently existing Democratic Party, which is currently probable presidential candidate, and its current balance of forces, I'm not seeing it changing super fast. I'd love it if it did, but I don't see it.
I remember vividly, you were talking about will Biden move in the direction you're discussing, and this is a horrible thing to talk about, I suppose, but I think back to some of the very first candidate debates of this last cycle, in which you had, it felt like you had 42 Democrats in a row. The reporter would say, Do you all agree that we should open, you know, we should have immigration, decriminalize the border? If you know, raise your hands. And you had 41 of the 42 raise their hands. And then there was Joe Biden, whose hand went up and then it went down and it went up and it went down. He just couldn't get it together to really go either direction. And, you know, I watch a lot of what happens in the Biden administration. I think he still has that hand going up and down and up and down and like that. But some things have gone well for him. He reached out to Joe Manchin, and the two of them together did some very constructive work. Prove that bipartisanship is not completely non-existent. And I hope, quite frankly, that the what successes Biden has achieved will be contagious to the Republican Party as well. A national consensus on one or two things would be a pleasant surprise.
Yes, that is devoutly to be wished.
So, thanks for coming on today. I enjoy your work. Let's end with a plug. You have a new book coming out. Is this the second book you've authored with John Judas, or have there been others?
Correct. The second book. It'll be out in November. Where Have All the Democrats Gone? And you can pre-order it now on Amazon.
No, I have a local bookstore, and I urge everyone hearing this, please go to your local bookstore and put in an order for the new book. Thanks for coming on.
Sure, it was fun.
Bye-bye, Ray. Whew. Rui Teixeira doesn't hold back. And I think it's important to separate his often sharp rhetoric from his proposals. His proposals are clearly a breach with progressives, but they are, as he claims, essentially restatements of the conventional values of the Democratic Party since the 1930s. But let me address two issues. Does the Democratic Party have to move to the center on a host of social issues? And does the party have to adopt an abundance agenda as sketched by Rui? Well, no. It absolutely doesn't have to adopt any of Teixeira's advice in order to win elections. Win them by the same narrow margins we've won for decades, and win elections now and then. Win, get an office, pass some stuff, and then lose power all over again. We have to remember, to govern, it is not enough to have the presidency. A president alone can't legislate at all. Sure, a president can talk a lot and has tremendous power in foreign policy. And a president can reinterpret existing laws to bend them to his or her will, somewhat. But a president cannot create or cut a tax, cannot create or cut a program, cannot create or cut a right. To move forward or to move backward, a president needs to win the votes in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And if that sounds hard to do, welcome to the United States Constitution, which is designed to limit the power of each branch, not to establish one branch as dominant. But that task, having unified control of the presidency and Congress, is achievable, because it's been achieved over and over again. The long era from 1933 to 1980, which I call the Roosevelt era, was the most recent example. But since the end of the Reagan era, composed of the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, there have been only three Democratic presidents: Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were in the presidency for 8 years, but the reality was that they were real presidents able to govern for only their first 2 years. Clinton was elected in 1992 with control of the House and Senate, then lost his control of Congress 2 years later in 1994, but clung to office until 2000. We Democrats call that success. His only major legislative victory after 1994 was welfare reform, which was passed with Republican votes because it was, well, largely a Republican proposal. Obama was elected in 2008 with overwhelming control of Congress, but lost his Congress 2 years later in 2010. Obama, like Clinton, was president, saying a lot and getting very little done until he left office in 2016. Another big success? Biden has been in an even worse pickle. He came into office with tiny majorities in the House and Senate. But true to form, he lost control of the House in his first election, 2022. Personally, I don't think we can count his 2 years as ones of Democratic Party government. But let's be charitable and count them in. Tote it up. In the last 35 years since the end of the Reagan era, there have been 6 years of unified Democratic Party governance. Is that what we Democrats want more of? Or is that what we hate? How do Democrats win elections, win big, and win over and over and over again? Teixeira's strongest argument isn't any particular fight he picks over one or another policy. It is his argument that to really govern, you must win big. And to win big means, almost by definition, that you must convince tens of millions of middle-of-the-road voters that the Democratic Party speaks with their voice and is on their side. That voice will not become an ideological consistent voice, because those Americans in the middle are simply not ideologues. My guess is that most Americans in the center are old-fashioned American pragmatists. They like what works. That's Teixeira's strongest argument on elections. When Teixeira turns and discusses his abundance agenda, because it's about an economic issue, I think we assume he is speaking as some kind of economist with a specific proposal. Not so. He's speaking as a public intellectual urging us to have a goal. Teixeira is urging us to be dissatisfied with so-so economics that produces tiny improvements. Per capita GDP grew by 0.6% per year in the last 15 years. Whoopee! Just as Teixeira says we should be dissatisfied with so-so presidential victories, we should be dissatisfied with so-so economics. And how do we move from so-so economics to a renewed vitality? If you have followed this podcast, you will recall that I have had conversations with a group of academics and journalists who want to put flesh on the idea that in this country we can restore prosperity that is widely shared, something we haven't seen since when? Maybe the early 70s? Maybe the 60s? What would you say? David Autor of MIT explained MIT's plan to save the middle class. Duran Acemoglu of MIT spoke on the dual face of technology, which can replace workers or can enhance their value at work. Danny Roderick of Harvard spoke to us on the next economic paradigm. Globalization is out and productivism is in, says Danny. Rana Faruhar of the Financial Times spoke on moving from globalization to a focus on local production. And Brad DeLong of Berkeley reminded us that the fate of the overall economy is crucially important. Will any particular program to restore widely shared prosperity flourish if the whole economy is sunk in recession, or if it is suffering from uncontrolled inflation? Brad, a macroeconomist, reminded us that the macroeconomy can't be overlooked. Does this group have all the answers? Of course not, and they wouldn't claim they do. Literally, they are struggling toward the answers. And here, at the Political Conversation, so are we. This podcast will continue to explore the ideas of the best people America has to offer on how we can restore an economy that works for all of us. My bet is that the answer has a lot to do with what my guests have had to say, and that the rest of the answer will come in the next few years as we continue these political conversations. My thanks to Rui Teixeira for coming on the podcast to deliver his message, and to my producer, Anna Kumu, for her always stellar work. Next time, I will speak with Gordon Hanson of Harvard, who is a leader in the effort to, as he says, reimagine the economy. I'll ask him to describe his efforts. It'll be a kind of status report on the progress toward a better America. I'll see you next time on the Political Conversation.